Welcome to Idle Chatter, brought to you by the Machinery Digest, where steel and soil meet. A weekly podcast by a New Jersey farmer to all farmers and ranchers across this great nation. And yes, there are farms in New Jersey. Regardless of the crop you grow or the livestock you raise, we all have one thing in common. Agriculture runs on passion, sweat, tears, and machinery. And that is why the Machinery Digest exists. A no-nonsense, grease-under-your-fingernails educational website. It was created to provide a transfer of knowledge so that you can maintain, service, and most importantly, understand today's complex farm equipment. My name is Ray Bohax, and I farm too. It is time now to get under the sheet metal. Hello and welcome back to Idle Chatter. Ray Bohax here, the hot rod farmer from Cat Swamp Road in Warren County. And yes, there are farms in New Jersey. And wishing you a great day and hopefully, as I always say, that things are going great on your farm or ranch operation as we get ready for Christmas, the arrival of our Savior, Jesus Christ, as a baby born in a manger amongst animals. And it's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful time of year, and I hope that you all have the opportunity to take the time and reflect on that birth and not get mired and lost in the busyness of the season. But also, I do want to, a little bit self-promotion here. I guess nothing's wrong with that. Well, I guess there is something wrong with it, but it's really not self-promotion. But if you haven't already checked it out on the website, farmmachinerydigest.com, which is my website, obviously, plus on all of my hosting sites that host the Idle Chatter podcast. I have my second annual Christmas What to Get the Hot Rod Farmer in Your Life Buyer's Guide. So I did that last year, as I said before, a couple of weeks back, and it was very well received. And I have a new show up there, and also in the archives is the old show from last year. So you could listen to that, and then you could also go on the website and you could see the actual items that I discuss and get a direct link to the company's website, and you could check it out. So keep in mind that if you are the hot rod farmer because you're listening to this, right, then you could buy that for yourself or make a suggestion to someone, all right, that's... sometimes doesn't go across too well, but my thought basically is if somebody's going to spend some money on you, that they love you and they want to get you something nice for Christmas, that it'd be better served to get you something that you could use and it'll bring value to your life, and every time you look at them that you'll remember that. So check that out if you have not already done that. And also keep in mind that every week on Ag News Daily, which is Delaney Howell and Mike Pearson's daily agricultural news show, that on every Thursday I have a Hot Rod Farmer Minute, and then there's also a different Hot Rod Farmer Minute played each week on the Moving Iron Podcast Network, and that is Casey Seymour, and then I am also warehousing those on my website, but we're putting up three a week. I actually have about 33 of them right now, I believe, but we're putting up three a week so we don't overwhelm you and you have something to look forward to. So that is that. And let me see what else. I told you last week I got my Davis Vantage View. I can never remember the name. Vantage View Weather Station. And I really love it. I'm learning a lot about weather. I'm certainly not a meteorologist, or I guess a quasi-weather buff. But I didn't really know too much about it. Years ago, I got a wonderful book on weather, and I studied the aspects of humidity and barometric pressure and temperature simply because they affect an engine. So, but I wonder now that I have the weather station, and it's so easy at a glance to look at everything. I'm learning the station. I got it set up the way I want it set up right now with the quick view, so I could see the different things that I'm interested in. But like so many things, they have those multifunction buttons, and I guess there's no other way to do it or bring it to market inexpensively without making the thing 50 feet wide. But you press the wrong button and it screws everything up. Pardon my French. But hey, what are you going to do? So I'm learning. So I got it set the way I want right now. And then each day or each couple of days, I'm taking the manual out and I'm going through it. I'm exploring different areas of it. But what's interesting is that Friday, I looked at it Friday morning in the kitchen and before I went down to my office, and then it said, I'm probably pronouncing it wrong, Geminitis, meteor shower. And I said, I first thought it said Gemini DS, due south meteor shower, because it uses that funky computer type of graphics, or font, I should say. But then I looked it up, and it was the Geminitis meteor shower this past weekend, and it's supposedly a very large, well-known meteor shower. We did not get a chance to see it over the 3 days because it was cloudy and it was raining here. So it wasn't pouring. I think over the course of the 3 days, we got about 0.55 inches of rain. But it was just enough to cancel out the meteor shower. So maybe some of you guys saw that around the world. And here I am, right? I'm a day late and a dollar short. I'm telling you after the fact. But the next year, if it comes up before my podcast on there, I'll let you know when it is. And it seems like it's quite a spectacular to see all of those meteors shooting across the sky. So I would love to have seen that, but God willing, next year. And let me see what else I want to tell you. And I think we're getting ready for some snow and ice again this week. It's been an icy past month. And so after I record this show, I'm going to get the generator all fueled up and get that, make sure that's all got enough fuel in case the power goes out again as it did last time. And God willing, it doesn't go out for people who are not prepared for it. And hopefully it kind of is a benign event. So we're supposed to get ice, a quarter of an inch of ice, and then snow, 3 to 5 inches of snow, and then ice again, which was the same drill we had about 2 weeks ago and took out a lot of power lines here in Warren County. So hopefully, God willing, it's not too bad where you are, and you could travel safely and get. I know these guys have crops in the field. I've seen pictures of guys going through the field with a combine with snow on the ground. So, hey, it is what it is, but know that I wish you sincerely the best, and we'll get through all of this, and 2020 is just around the corner. And I also want to tell you that launching on New Year's Day, and it'll stay on the website and the hosting sites also, launching on New Year's Day will be my prayer for you, my wishes for you, a short podcast, about a 15 or 20 minute podcast, if even that, which I did not do yet, so I'm going to try to keep it tight at about 15 or 20 minutes, and some thoughts as we enter 2020. I did that last year for 2019, and I enjoyed doing it, and it gives me an opportunity, independent of the technical content of the podcast, to give you some thoughts to ponder and things to think about. And it's not that, please don't ever think that I feel that I'm smarter than anyone else or what have you. But, you know, in life, we learn from each other. And that's why I love to have an intellectual exchange with my listeners and readers of the website, because I learn from them and they learn from me. Hopefully they learn from me. But, you know, lots of times if somebody just presents something to you in a different manner and it makes it click, it becomes almost like an epiphany, like a really special moment, and you put all the dots together. So that's what that show is all about. I like to hopefully do my best to inspire people and to educate them and to bring them to a possibly a different mindset or just different way of looking at things. So if you get a chance, please listen to that. I know that it is not time sensitive, right? Because it doesn't time out after January 1st. And, you know, each day is a new day, a blessing from God. And any mistakes we made, you know, it's never too late to try to turn either your life around or your business around or what have you. So hopefully you enjoy that and it'll be up scheduled for January 1st. But with all of that homework and housekeeping stuff done, I would like to do now or go, it's time now, I should say, that would be right, put my tongue back in my mouth, my brain gets ahead of my tongue. It's always been my life story. Right? My brain is going 90 miles an hour, and my tongue only goes 40 miles an hour. But it's time now for Bushels and Cents. And I want to truly drive home the message that success on the farm or ranch is a three-legged stool. It's agronomy or animal husbandry, marketing, and machinery. I feel the best way is to take real-life scenarios and establish how a poor decision or inaccurate diagnosis of a machinery issue costs your operation money. But instead of referencing just dollars, I will reference it in crop, and I'm using corn at $3.50 a bushel. And never forget, it's not what you make, but what you keep that counts. You ready? So, with that said, here is our example of bushels and cents. During the first day of harvest, your combine goes into limp mode and will only crawl. You call the dealer and they send a technician out. He reads the code and says that it is turbo over speed. He changes the speed sensor, same problem. Changes the ECU, same problem. A few days later, you notice a dirty ground. You clean it and all is fine. The repair bill is $4,000, and none of the parts were needed. It is, if a simple ground circuit voltage drop test was performed, it would have been fixed for free. Instead, it cost you the equivalent of 1,143 bushels of corn. Let this not be you. So I've talked so many times about doing the proper way, and the only way to check a ground circuit is through a voltage drop test. And in this particular instance, which is very common, these are all true stories I wanted to tell you. These are not stuff that I'm pulling out of air or making up as I go along. That over my years of talking to people, and this actual gentleman contacted me about a year or two ago, and he was from, I believe, someplace in the Midwest, I think Indiana, and he had a John Deere combine. And that was his scenario, and I told him to go around and check the ground circuits, and they did find a faulty ground, and that was basically it. It was a corroded ground, what we would call a high impedance ground. So, let this not be you, and I hopefully that you will take heed to bushels and cents every week. And, I can't come up with it. I can't have every scenario, but it's more important for you to modify your thought process. And in this particular instance, $3.50 bushel corn, $4,000 thrown out down the toilet, all right, in the septic. It's in the septic now, right, because it was totally wasted. Didn't need an ECU, didn't need a turbocharger, overspeed sensor, didn't need all those service repairs that the guy kept coming out. And God knows what he messed up when he was doing that, which is another story. And that's the equivalent of 1,143 bushels of corn. And if you were dumping 1,143 bushels of corn in a ditch, right, you would say that you're crazy. Why is somebody doing that? Well, that's what that basically cost that farmer. Alrighty, so we will move on. And as always, if you have any questions or comments on this, on the bushels and cents, or anything else on this show, please feel free to contact me at hotrodfarmer@farmmachinerydigest.com. And for our special delivery letter this week, I do have somebody who contacted me about the show this week on the radiator pressure caps. So we will get to him, and it is, I believe his name is Mr. Scott Shady, S-H-A-D-Y, like a shade tree. All right. What today's topic is going to be about is something that you really don't hear people talking about, I mean mechanics talking about it, all right? And I don't mean, with coffee shop talk or at the church function or what have you, but it is about exhaust restrictions specifically in a gasoline engine, or what we would say is a plugged exhaust. And that is probably more common than you actually think. And it causes a lot of misdiagnosis, and it causes a lot of issues, and you spend a lot of money, a lot of time, and then you get nowhere with it. You got nothing, all right, but a lot of money, a lot of time in it. So I want to cover that topic, and we're going to look at it relatively in depth today on the show. And the thing about a restricted exhaust, plugged exhaust, whatever term you want to use, is that it has the ability to affect every gasoline engine, and it also has the ability to affect the modern diesel engine. And I'm going to hopefully remember to bring that to you at the end of that segment and discuss that. But whether it's a small engine on a chainsaw, or whether it's a gasoline engine in a pickup truck, car, irrigation pump, what have you, is that it has the ability to affect any type of gasoline engine, and also, as I said, a modern Tier 4 diesels, as you will understand why as I progress. But first, excuse me, we need to have a little bit of a timeline and history of restricted exhaust. Now, years ago, the only way that, and we're talking years ago, I'm going to say prior to catalytic converters, we're talking about gasoline engines. I'm going to talk about bigger gasoline engines, and I'll break away into smaller stuff as the opportunity comes up. But prior to the advent of a catalytic converter, which was 1975, all right, for you guys that are young, you don't remember that. I remember when catalytic converters came out. I was a little kid and always read all the car magazines and mechanics magazines and what have you. So prior to a catalytic converter is that the only way you would get a restricted exhaust would be one of two possibilities. Number one, you rode over something or hit something and you crushed the exhaust pipe underneath the vehicle. Or the second thing was that a baffle came apart in the muffler. Well, lots of times they had resonators, mufflers and resonators. The muffler is always first and the resonator is after that. And the resonator was used to help quiet the exhaust. So Cadillacs, Lincolns, Imperials, Ford LTD, whatever may have a resonator on it and a muffler. But in essence, you either had to have a collapsed exhaust pipe someplace, you had to crush it right over it, whatever, dent it and close it, crushed. And then, or you had to have a baffle come apart in the muffler. And depending upon the intricacy of the muffler, that this baffle could block the exit and cause the back pressure, cause the exhaust to not exit the engine. Right? And then the third thing, which I won't even say it's a third thing, it's two, let's make it 2A instead of number three, is that, you know, being on a farm or whatever, you could have something crawl up into the exhaust and make a nest like a family of mice and what have you, and usually the nest catches fire and burns, but, you know, hey, if the vehicle sat there for quite some time or it's a seasonal use engine or piece of equipment, that they could build a pretty good nest in there. But usually that would kind of blow itself out or burn itself out. So the thing is that either just crushed pipe or crushed muffler or the muffler coming apart inside. So now what we have to – what we need to do is we're going to talk about how this impacts the engine. Now, once the catalytic converter came about – in 1975 up until today, gasoline engines, the catalytic converter is not going away. So the thing is that the catalytic converter changed everything and made a restricted exhaust much more common than it ever was before, because we still had the elements of crushing the exhaust or the muffler coming apart, but there was always the possibility of the catalytic converter melting inside. And once it melted inside, that it will cause a exhaust restriction. All right, so let's stop right there, and let me explain to you briefly, without going off on a tangent, hopefully. You guys are patient with me. You know that I'm passionate about this, and sometimes I got to reel myself in. But a catalytic converter, for the most part today, has a monolith. And a monolith looks like a honeycomb in a bee's nest. And FYI, the early catalytic converters back in 1975 and probably till about 1980, General Motors did not use a monolith. They used what they called a bead or pellet type of converter, and Ford, Chrysler, and AMC used a monolith type of converter, the honeycomb type of converter. And what a catalytic converter does in simplistic terms is that it has precious metals, rhodium, palladium in them, and a catalyst by nature of definition means it's something that speeds up or alters a chemical reaction without itself becoming consumed. So the catalytic converter is used to scrub the carbon monoxide and hydrocarbon exhaust coming out of an engine, and it's used to make it into something benign, all right, which will not impact the atmosphere. So it makes it changes it into CO2, which is like in a soda bottle, all right? So that's in essence what it does. So the exhaust, the chemical elements in the exhaust, the carbon monoxide, which is partially burned fuel, and the hydrocarbons, which is unburned fuel. When you open up a can, or if you have a gas can, like a 5-gallon gas, you open up it and you smell the gas, that's the vapors, is the hydrocarbon vapors. So it takes those from the exhaust and converts them to something benign, carbon dioxide. You ready? And then it goes out into the atmosphere. And it does this by these precious metals. There's a lot of chemistry involved with it and the precious metals interacting with that in the exhaust. Now, the interesting thing about a catalytic converter, be it a monolith type of converter that's honeycomb or being a bead type of converter, is that that it only efficiently does this at an engine-out air-fuel ratio of 14.7:1, which is what's called stoichiometric. That means it's the most efficient chemical conversion, chemical energy to mechanical energy conversion. So it's an air-fuel ratio of 14.7:1. An unleaded fuel that we've used for, and whether it's got E10 in it, E20, or whatever, is designed around keeping the catalytic converter happy. So it needs to see a air-fuel ratio of 14.7:1 for the converter to be the most efficient. The most efficient, and we'll use the term scrubbing the exhaust for CO and HC, carbon monoxide, and hydrocarbons. Now, the catalytic converter, when the engine is first started, is not functional. It needs to reach a certain temperature inside to be functional, and that is around 900 degrees. This is a gasoline catalytic converter, all right? A diesel oxidation catalyst needs to reach about 600 degrees, but don't be concerned with that right now. But the catalytic converter needs to reach to about 900 degrees. And like an oven, like you're cooking in an oven, the temperature doesn't come up instantly. It ramps up. And then once the converter reaches around 900 degrees, it becomes its most efficient, and that is what is called light off. It's like shutting a light off, L-I-G-H-T, but it's L-I-T-E, light off. You'd say, in engineering, you say, we got to get the converter to be lit off, all right? So once it's lit off, it's going to scrub the exhaust. Prior to that, when the converter is cold, when you first start the engine, it doesn't scrub the exhaust. As it starts to build some heat from the engine running, it starts to clean up a little bit. And then what happens, basically, is that at one particular point, it comes on the pipe, right? It gets, you know, like comes on the turbo there, right? It's all becomes efficient, and then it starts to scrub the exhaust. Now, there is a bell curve as far as the operating temperature of the converter. So it needs to build heat, and then it becomes efficient. And then what will happen is that if the mixture is richer than 14.7:1, what will happen is that the converter will start to superheat. So it'll get much hotter than 900 degrees. And if it gets much hotter than 900 degrees over time, what will happen is that it will start to melt that monolith or those pellets, all right? And then it'll cool back off and it'll solidify. So it'll end up over time. It doesn't happen, you know, in 10 miles. Over time, it will now block the exhaust and not allow the exhaust to exit. So the number one thing you need to take home here is that any engine that is fitted with a catalytic converter, and you know a lot of motorcycles even fitted with catalytic converters today. The thing is that is the engine, if it runs too rich for a long period of time, it is going to superheat that converter, and then it is going to start to melt down and gives you the, and will start to cause an exhaust restriction. Alrighty? So we always said in the industry is that catalytic converters don't die, they're murdered, and they're murdered by a rich air-fuel ratio. And now what will happen is that once the air-fuel ratio gets goes and starts to get richer, 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 it actually has too much fuel in it and not enough oxygen, and it actually extinguishes the converter. It's not lit off anymore. So we would say the converter is extinguished, and when the converter is extinguished, then it doesn't scrub the exhaust, but also it doesn't have the ability to hurt itself. So it's right at that line, like a surfer riding the curve of the wave, is that you have a very little window of proper air-fuel ratio to keep the converter happy and efficient. You go slightly richer than that, you start to superheat it and melt it down, and you go richer than the superheating temperature, and then it extinguishes and shuts off the converter, because what basically happens is that the additional fuel displaces all of the oxygen content in the converter, and then it doesn't have the ability to make heat. Now, if you ever been on the road, you're going to town or something like that, and this is very common years ago with carbureted engines, is that somebody would pass you, they'd whack it to the floor right in a two-lane, they're going to pass you, and then they go by, you smell that rotten egg, that sulfur smell. Well, that's from an overheated catalytic converter, and the logic in the calibration of the carburetor to fuel injection is that at wide open throttle, they're going to flood it with a lot of fuel, and then this fuel will extinguish the converter. So if the person keeps their foot to the floor, or you're pulling a trailer up a long grade, and you got this thing matted, right, that you don't hurt the converter. So as the converter is being superheated and then going to extinguish, you'll smell that sulfur, that rotten egg smell. If you're smelling that rotten egg smell all the time, that converter's in that danger zone because you have the mixture is too rich. Alrighty? So now we understand that. And that is why the diagnosis or the frequency of a restricted exhaust was not something we really had to deal with years ago and knew how an engine responded, because, like I said, other than crushing something, all right, running over the pipe and crushing something, then this is a new phenomena because of the catalytic converter. So now what happens is this, that on an engine, we have the four strokes of an engine. So there's intake, compression, power, and exhaust. All righty? Even though that was taught to us that way, intake is when the cylinder is being filled with charge. Compression is when it's being compressed near the spark plug. And then we have power is when the spark plug ignites. And now in engineering, that's not the proper term. We don't call it power. That's the layperson's term that they taught you in shop class, intake, compression, power, exhaust. What the proper term for the third stroke of a four-cycle engine is the expansion stroke, because the spark plug ignites the fuel-air mixture, and then the fuel-air mixture expands, and that's what drives the piston down. So that's called the expansion stroke. And then the fourth stroke they taught you wrong in simplistic terms, right? They're going to call it the exhaust. It's exhausting the cylinder, right? But that's not the proper name either. The proper name is the pumping loop. So the third stroke is called the expansion stroke, and the fourth stroke is called the pumping loop. Now what happens is that the expansion of the charge drives the piston down in the bore. When the piston gets to bottom dead center, the crankshaft is still turning, but the piston dwells at bottom dead center. On each stroke, the piston dwells at top dead center and bottom dead center for a certain amount of crankshaft rotational degrees. Now, when it's dwelling at bottom dead center, the crankshaft is still turning, but the way the angularity in the connecting rod, in the journal, the angle of the crankshaft journal has the piston stop and dwell there. But since the crankshaft is still turning, the camshaft is turning, and when the piston is at bottom dead center, the exhaust valve starts to open. So the piston is dwelling at bottom dead center, and the exhaust valve cracks open. When the exhaust valve cracks open, that is called blowdown. B-L-O-W-D-O-W-N, blowdown. All right? So now, since high pressure goes to low pressure, what's happening is as soon as that exhaust valve starts to crack open, moves off the seat, the pressure in the cylinder is higher, the leftover residual pressure from that combustion event, that all does not get used to convert into crankshaft action, is higher than in the exhaust port, so now the cylinder starts to evacuate on its own. Once the pressure in the exhaust port of the cylinder and the cylinder bore equalize, the pressure is not going anywhere. And that is why it is called the pumping loop. So now the piston, now the exhaust valve is open further because the crankshaft is turning. The piston is driving towards top dead center, and it is pushing the residual, the inert exhaust gas, or which we get EGR from, exhaust gas recirculation, takes that and pushes it out of the cylinder, getting ready to fill it with fresh charge. Because if you didn't push that cylinder out, I mean that exhaust gas out, you would have no room for fresh charge. Two things can't occupy the same place at the same time. So now, when you have a restricted exhaust on a gasoline engine, it is like a person with a plug out like this. All right? What's happening is that the blowdown event is very inefficient, and now the piston needs to try to push all of that, to push all of that exhaust gas, spent exhaust gas, out of the cylinder bore. And so it's like, man, what a plug mouth like I'm going. It's just, or it's like a plug drain on a sink, right? Or a plug pipe. It can't push it out. So what's happening is that on a multi-cylinder engine, the expansion cycle for the next cylinder, the firing order, let's say number one fired, now it's number eight, whatever the firing order is, instead of using all of that energy to drive the crankshaft, it's using that energy from the expansion of the next cylinder in the firing event to go and to try to push the piston up on the cylinder that should have been that in the pumping loop. So it's what's called a parasitic loss. And that is why the first sign of a restricted exhaust system, and you know this happens, you know, with a catalytic converter, this happens, sneaks up on you like gray hair, well, weeds in a field. It doesn't happen. You wake up one day and all the weeds are there, right? You go there one day, you see a weed over here, see another weed, and a week later you see more, and all of a sudden the field's covered with weeds. We had that happen this year. A lot of guys had it happen back east. Is that we had a fall panicum take over when late August, when the pre you gave up the ghost. But anyway, so now this energy is being used. So the first sign of a restricted exhaust on an engine is that it will start to have a lack of power, a lack of throttle response. Idle fine, do everything fine at light load. Why? Because there's not that much energy required and there's not that much charge in the cylinder. But then as the restriction gets worse and worse and worse or more intensified, this engine will have a lack of power, and then eventually will not even start and run. You know, if you get it to run, it'll run like a 300, 400 RPM, like that, all right? It'll hardly run. But this doesn't happen overnight. So now on a one or two cylinder engine, a small engine, let's say in a seat tender or what have you, if you get an exhaust restriction, the thing is that lots of times that engine will start and idle, may be hard starting because what's happening is that it can't get the exhaust out, all right, when you're pulling it with a rope or with an electric start or whatever you happen to have, all right, and then when it does run, it could idle, and it may idle fine, but when you go to give it throttle, it bogs. Because you have to keep in mind that if you are not exhausting that cylinder, not only is the energy being used from the next cylinder in an event, but if you only have a one-cylinder engine, it's got to wait for that next event to come up on that cylinder. It doesn't have the ability, like a multi-cylinder engine, to steal that power from the next cylinder in the firing event. So if you have a one-cylinder engine on a chainsaw, weed whacker, whatever, or a one-cylinder engine on a pump at your transfer pump, what have you, it's got to wait for the next cycle to come up, the next expansion event to try to evacuate the cylinder. But because it's only a one-cylinder engine, it doesn't have the room to bring the charge in because it's still got exhaust gas there. and also on any engine, one-cylinder, multi-cylinder, because the exhaust cannot get out, it's going to affect the manifold vacuum, which impacts the fuel delivery, all right? The charge, whether it's a carburetor or fuel injection, the charge is the fuel and air mixed together. And what's going to happen is that it gets into the cylinder by a pressure differential. So the thing is that if you – so what is vacuum? Vacuum is any pressure less than atmospheric. All right, so if the atmospheric pressure is 30 inches of mercury today, and you have the piston coming down and it's pulling it down to 10 inches of mercury, the charge, the fuel and air mixture, whether it's carbureted or fuel injected, gets into that cylinder by the pressure differential. It's pushed into the cylinder. If you have a restricted exhaust and the cylinder is filled with pressure because it did not evacuate and blow down when the exhaust valve cracked open, or it can't push it all out with the piston, then what is going to happen to the charge? It can't get in the cylinder. And if it does, and first, as I said, this sneaks up on you like gray hair. It doesn't go from running perfectly to this. The first sign is that the carburetor, right, or fuel injection system, but specifically a carburetor, the signal, the signal in the carburetor, which in the booster, which pulls fuel from the flow pole through the metering circuits, becomes skewed, and the carburetor dumps fuel. It doesn't atomize it. And people pull the plugs out and say, well, it's running rich. It's really not running rich. It's that it's not atomizing the fuel because it's not taking as much fuel as it should, but it's not atomizing and breaking up in small particles. So the person blames the carburetor. It's not the carburetor. It's the exhaust system. The exhaust system. So basically, in essence, to sound crude, all right, and hey, whatever, I'm from New Jersey, right, so whatever, I don't have much of a filter, the engine is constipated, all right? That's what it basically boils down to. The engine is constipated, and once it's constipated, all bets are off on how the fuel system is going to work, all bets are off on how the ignition curve is going to work, how the engine is going to breathe, and what have you, all right? Now, before I go off, I want to explain it. The good thing about it, it's very simple for you to check this if you're suspicious of it. But let's talk about the small engines first. You could say, hey, Hot Rod, in the beginning you were talking about saying catalytic converter. My chainsaw don't have a catalytic converter. No, it doesn't, at least not yet, thank God, right? Or your small engine on your seat tender. But most of those engines have some people call it a spark arrester or a flame arrester in the exhaust. And if that engine was not tuned properly or had a lot of cold starts or a lot of running cycles, short duty cycles, you start it up, run it for 1 or 2 minutes and shut it off or what have you, depending upon the use, is that you will carbon up that muffler and that flame arrest or spark arrest or whatever you want to call it. And it is very common. So you get a restricted exhaust. It's specific like on chainsaws. All right, they'll have a spark arrester there. And then it usually screws into the muffler, and if depending, like I have steel product, you could unthread it and you could take it out and clean it. But the thing I want you to say to you is that even though it does not have a catalytic converter, even though you did not crush the exhaust, and even though it's a two-stroke motor, all right, the fact that the two-stroke engine, it's not a motor, electric motor, electric is motor. If it has combustion, it's an engine. But the fact of the matter is that it will respond the same way. So if you have a small engine that is starting to give you problems starting, lacking power, bogging, what have you, all of the above, all right, seems to not have proper fuel delivery, you either take that muffler off and look inside or take that spark arrestor out and look inside there and try to start it without that, all right? And then if it runs fine, you'll probably see that that is carboned up. Now, I wanted to cover that because that's a very common problem. Now, let's get back to a larger engine, gasoline engine. The easiest way for you to determine, and it's very, very, very simple. All you need is a vacuum gauge to determine if the engine has a restricted exhaust. What you need to do is you take your vacuum gauge out of your toolbox. That's something you probably bought 40 years ago. Probably was American-made, right? All the ones now are from China. They're junk. But anyway, You take that vacuum gauge and you hook it up to a manifold vacuum port. And in an engine, there's two types of vacuum. There's ported vacuum and there's manifold vacuum. Manifold vacuum means that that signal is derived below the throttle plate of the carburetor or the throttle plate of the fuel injection system. All right? And a ported vacuum signal, which is sometimes referred to as a timed vacuum because the throttle needs to be open far enough for it to actually expose vacuum to that port, is above the throttle plate someplace, all right? So you're hooking it up to a manifold vacuum signal, manifold vacuum source, and you're going to start the engine, all right? And like I said, you can't do this on a one-cylinder engine or two-cylinder because there's no place to read vacuum. But on any other type of gasoline engine, what you could do is you could start the engine, not, you hook up the manifold vacuum gauge, and you start the engine, and you read your vacuum. So let's say it's 14 inches at idle, 16 inches, let's say 17 inches at idle, right? That seems to be running fine at 17 inches at idle. Now what you do is you slowly raise the throttle, raise the engine speed, to 2,000, 2,100, 2,500, whatever, in that range between 2,000, 2,500, and hold it steady. And you want to look at your vacuum gauge reading. All right, so let's assign numbers to this to make it simplistic. So at idle, you have 17 inches of vacuum. Beautiful, good. Now you raise the engine speed, and you hold it there at 2,000 RPM, and you look at your vacuum gauge. All right? If the exhaust is restricted, the vacuum will either stay the same or will diminish. What you're supposed to see, because the piston speed is faster, is higher, all right, you're supposed to see an increase in vacuum. So if you had 17 inches of mercury at idle on the vacuum gauge, now you've raised the engine speed up, you should have 19, 20, 21, 22, what have you. If you see 17 or below, then that engine has a restricted exhaust. It is that simple, and if it has a catalytic converter, most likely the issue is there, but keep in mind it could be in the muffler or it could be you know, crushed pipe. But a two-second test takes you longer to go to the toolbox. So if you're suspicious of this engine, you say, man, this thing is becoming doggy. It doesn't seem to have the power it had. It doesn't seem to want to, I put a load on it. Doesn't want to seem to pull it. Doesn't seem to RPM up as quick. So I do that vacuum test. Simple. Simple as could be. Right? Get that vacuum port. Check it at idle, check it at 2,000 RPM, and you could take this to the bank, baby. If that vacuum does not increase and it stays the same or decreases, most of the time you'll see a decrease, then that engine has a restricted exhaust. And the easiest thing for you to do to confirm that, if it has an oxygen sensor, you could pull the oxygen sensor out, you're not going to hurt anything, and start it and see if it gets better, or you could drop the exhaust system, what have you. But that is 100% proof positive test for a restricted exhaust. All righty? Vacuum at idle, vacuum at 2,000 RPM. Vacuum at 2,000 RPM should be at least 2 inches of mercury stronger than vacuum at idle. If it isn't, you have a restricted exhaust. Then now all bets are off how that engine is going to run. And if it's a catalytic converter equipped vehicle, remember that catalyst melted down inside because that engine was running too rich or had a lot of cold starts or idled with the choke on, what have you. The catalyst, cats, we call it cats for short, cats don't die, they're murdered. And when they're murdered, what they do is they pay you back for being murdered by melting down inside and restricting the exhaust. Alrighty, so that is very, very, very simple. On a smaller engine, you'll have to open up the exhaust somehow, take the flame arrestor out, take the muffler out, what have you. On a larger engine, vacuum test, all right, and then go from there, and then you'll find that it has that is what your issue is, case closed. Now, on a modern diesel engine, prior to the Tier 4 systems, is that it would fall prey to the same thing like a gas engine. You either crushed a pipe or had something in the muffler, a baffle came apart in the muffler, what have you. But on a Tier 4 engine where you have a diesel oxidation catalyst, which is first, then you have the diesel particulate filter, and then you have the selective catalytic reduction system, the SCR system, which uses the diesel exhaust fluid to convert oxides of nitrogen to a benign, safe gas. All right, the diesel particulate filter is going to store. And I did a whole show on TF4. You can look it up in the archives. It's going to store the particulates, and then at a certain time, when it goes to what's called a regen cycle, it is going to burn those particulates off and convert the particulate to ash. Ash takes up less room than a particulate does. But at one particular point, that diesel particulate filter is going to be filled with ash, and then needs to be removed, and it needs to be cleaned out, which is something you can't do at the farm, all right? And there's certain procedures. They actually put it in an oven, they scrape it, they scrub it and clean it, and then they bake it in an oven at a higher temperature to bake it off. Now, most, if not all, diesel particulate filters, you have a pressure sensor in and out, and they measure the pressure coming, the exhaust pressure coming in the DPF and out of the DPF, and that's how they determine when they need to do a regen cycle about how much soot or particulates are in there. Now, keep in mind, even if you did all the regens, did everything properly at one particular point, that's going to need to be cleaned out. So as it starts to build ash in it, it's going to become an exhaust restriction, and it's going to act just like a gasoline motor with a plugged catalytic converter. It's going to start to lose power, start to lose fuel economy. You're going to see the boost gauge coming up, but it's over boosting. Exhaust gas temperature is going to get higher because it's not exhausting that heat from that cylinder. But the only saving grace is, in theory, right, it should tell you, set a trouble code, and a service engine soon light up what we would call a telltale, telling you that the diesel particulate filter is plugged and needs to be removed and cleaned. But keep in mind that as that starts to come up, all right, and there's a threshold for that pressure as far as in that calibration for it to set that code. So, you know, just like we did in our bushels and cents today, that combine had an over speed code for the turbo. It had nothing to do with that. It was a bad ground. It was tricking it. So keep in mind that that's what will happen with a diesel engine, is that you will be a modern diesel. Once you start to plug that diesel particulate filter with ash from so many regen cycles, it needs to be removed, and it'll respond like a gasoline engine that has a restricted exhaust. It's the same phenomena. It can't push it out. The pressure is staying high in the bore instead of going low in the bore. All right. So, any questions on that? But keep in mind that it's a very simple test, vacuum gauge, and you'll. Do this on all your gasoline engines. It's 2 seconds. I mean, you hook up the vacuum gauge, check the vacuum and idle, check it at 2,000 RPM. If it's higher and good, then you have no exhaust restriction, move on. But it's something that you could start to sneak up and see that exhaust is starting to get restricted before you even actually feel it in the way the engine responds under load, be it at a irrigation pump or be it on a truck or whatever, what have you. All right, so keep that in mind. As I said, any questions or concerns, please feel free to contact me at hotrodfarmer@farmmachinerydigest.com. All right, so now it's going to be time for our toolbox test. And as you know, the toolbox test is being brought to you by Agro Liquid Fertilizer, perfectly calibrated crop nutrition that allows you to hit your yield target by giving your crops what they need. It's riding that curve, like I said, like that air-fuel ratio, stoichiometric. It's environmentally sound and efficient because it's giving the crops what it needs to be productive. Because, you know, it's not drag racer syndrome. You know, drag racer syndrome is a little bit as good, a lot is better, right? Fertility is not that way. So you need to give the crop what it needs. An agro liquid will allow you to hit that target with their formula of high efficiency, low salt fertilizer. So check them out. I'm an agro-liquid farm, and I know if you check them out, that you will be also. But now, as always, we have to invite Tex Rabinowitz in from Ripsaw Records, and he is going to sing the Hot Rod Man as we get into our toolbox test. So come on and hit it, Tex.
I'm a hot rod man. Yeah, I'm a hot rod man. Look out, little mama, gonna get you if I can.
All righty, Tex. Thank you so much. Thank you for coming on board over here and being the official music from Ripsaw Records, the official music of the Toolbox Test. So you know when you hear Hot Rod Man, you better put your thinking cap on because the test question is coming up next. So we are this week... Still on toolbox test number 2. As I said, these are all on my website. So you could go take them. I think there's 14 or 15 of them up now, and they all have 5 questions to them. All right. So we're on question number 4 of test number 2. Your summer vacation is over, and you are taking the time to get your combine ready for harvest. You look everything over and fit both the corn and bean headers to make sure all is well. When you first started the engine in the shop, you noticed a good amount of blue/white smoke from the exhaust. Thinking nothing of it, you went about your business. On the subsequent restarting of the engine, the smoke was still present and would dissipate in about 20 seconds. Then the exhaust would be clean. You would just change the engine oil and filter, and nothing stood out as being wrong. Where do you think the smoke is coming from? Alrighty. So Farmer A thinks that the seal in the turbocharger is going bad and is leaking. Farmer B gives you the news that he believes the piston rings are shot and you better hope for a good yield to pay for the repair. Boy, he's a real prince. Farmer C tells you not to worry. Most likely the smoke is from worn valve stem seals. And Farmer D laughs and says that's why he always buys a different color combine. We always got one of those in the group, right? That he's always got to be any problem that you have, you get a flat tire, it's because he uses a different color machine. So that's it. So as I always say to you, don't be concerned whether it's A, B, C, or D. Be concerned with what you think the issue is. So now we will go into our special delivery section, and then once we are done with that, I will give you the answer to that toolbox test question, and that means that this week's show is over. And I want to thank you in advance for listening. Okay, so special deliveries, you know, letters that are sent to me through my website and from people who listen to the show or read or go on the website or have a issue or concern or question about something. And special delivery is proudly brought to us by Firestone Ag, a company founded on Harvey Firestone. He's one of us. He was a fourth-generation farmer from Columbiana, Ohio. I'm not fourth-generation. I'm second-generation. But Harvey dreamed of putting rubber tires on farm tractors, and that innovative mindset is the core of Firestone Ag today. And lives on with their 23-degree tread bar tire design, the AD2 technology, which is the IF and VF tire, and then also the Firestone of tracks. The soil is the lifeblood of your farm. Trust it only to Firestone. And, you know, it's funny how even today with so much about no-till and soil compaction, there's a whole bunch of people out there who still want to fight that tooth and nail and tell you that it's a bunch of malarkey. Well, it's not a bunch of malarkey, and sadly, they need to change their mindset. So the soil is the lifeblood of your farm. All righty, so as I said, this is our letter, and it's from Mr. Shady, Seth Shady, and I will read it to you. I loved your podcast on radiator caps, found it very informative and backed up mistakes I've made in the past, which got me thinking about coolant and additives for diesels. There are so many generic snake oils out there for cleaners, boosters, and many other cures for common cooling system ailments. I'm overwhelmed in the classic tractor world, the great international harvester author Ken Updike preaches, I don't know who that is, preaches that the IH engines from the 1970s need a conditioner element plumbed into the system to prevent cavitation of the cylinder sleeve. John Deere sells a coolant conditioner to eliminate cavitation by way of surface tension and a protective film. My Kubota lawnmower from the 80s manual recommends running a cleaner fluid through it every so many hours. Then I have a Case diesel engine that isn't very specific, just coolant and water mixed to the safe temperature range. These are all wet sleeve motors, which I use recommended coolant in mixed to the appropriate ratio with demineralized water. Am I missing something with additives or conditioners? I really enjoy every podcast toolbox test and tweet you write. Keep up the good work. I'm far smarter now, and it makes my day. Thank you very much, Seth Shady. Well, thank you so much, Mr. Shady, for not only listening, but for writing and for learning that, you know, as an educator, nothing makes anyone feel happier than a student that is learning and enjoying learning. So to answer your question, sir, the thing basically is that there's two components to what you're saying, is that every diesel engine, even today, which is a like in a light-duty diesel that's in a pickup truck or what have you, which is not a wet-sleeve engine, it's a parent-bore engine. So the thing is that requires to have a additive package that will allow or not allow cylinder liner cavitation erosion to occur. And what that basically is that bubbles form and they implode like cavitation in a hydraulic pump or any type of system. They implode against the cylinder wall, the backside of the cylinder liner from the water jacket towards the actual piston, and they eat it away and they erode it, and eventually the coolant gets in the cylinder, and because liquid is non-compressible, that piston is coming up on that compression stroke. It gets water in the cylinder, water meaning coolant, and then it can't be compressed, so the piston breaks, the rod breaks, and historically it kicks it through the block. All right. The other thing is that the other problem with a diesel engine is you need to have this additive package in the coolant that eliminates cavitation and also eliminates electrolysis, all right, which is the coolant being used as a ground path. Now, so you need to have, and that's why you need to use a diesel-specific coolant, because the diesel-specific coolant has the proper additive package. Now, since diesel engines are so large, and they take a lot of coolant, what the industry has come up with many, many years ago are test strips. And those test strips will determine what additive the coolant needs. And you could buy something called an SCA, a supplemental coolant additive. So you don't have to renew all of the coolant. You put you juice it up with the additive package that is in this SCA. And then eventually, over time, you will need to replenish the coolant. All right, but you could extend its life cycle greatly by adding the SCA. On a small engine, let's say like your lawnmower, the Kubota, I would probably just change the coolant and not worry about an SCA. On a larger engine with 14, 15, 16 gallons of coolant, you could add an SCA and that'll be fine. And then eventually, but I do promote coolant testing. Oil or hydraulic system testing. It's going to be a telltale of what's going on. Now, the other part of your letter, so let me answer this, the first part. Every diesel engine needs to have a proper coolant in it that will eliminate the possibility of cavitation, cylinder liner cavitation erosion, and electrolysis. Whether you choose that by using the proper coolant and adding an SCA or changing the coolant, that is essential on every diesel engine. All right, so whether it's Kubota, whether it's John Deere, whether it's Classic IH, and that's probably what Mr. Updike was talking about, but you need to have that in any diesel engine, Detroit Diesel, Cummins, Cat, Powerstroke, what have you. All right, the other thing about saying is that that you want to use some sort of cleaner in the system. If you were good about keeping the coolant fresh and keeping it additized, and then you will not have corrosion built up in that system, and you would not need to wash it out. But what I would basically do is that if the engine is running fine and it has, and if it has a cylinder head surface temperature gauge and a liquid temperature gauge, if those are in parity or close to being what they should be, one of the telltale signs of having corrosion inside the cooling system is, and scale built up in the cooling system, is that you will have the cylinder head temperature will be much higher than normal, and the liquid temperature will be lower because that heat is not being transferred. And then you should clean it out with some type of product, as you were saying. The negative about those products is that they're predominantly acid-based. So even though they do clean the scale out, they attack a lot of gaskets and seals and have the potential to attack gaskets and seals, even if you have something like a heater core or a radiator and some of the solder joints are weak, then you would basically have the potential of eating that away and causing a leak that would not be there if you did not put that acid in there. So to answer your question, if you had these tractors for years, this equipment for years, and that would be a last ditch thing for me to try to put some sort of cleaner in there, even though Kubota told you on a lawn tractor you don't have to worry about a heater core, but you do have to worry about the water pump seals and the radiator and any place that that coolant goes. So to recap, yes, I would do coolant system analysis. It's about $20, $25 for each test. New coolant system analysis, keep the coolant renewed, or with a supplemental coolant additive, keep the additive package up to snuff. You will not have any scale, you will not have any electrolysis, and you will not have any cavitation liner erosion. And then when you do the coolant system test, it could actually see if there's any erosion going on, because of what it's going to do is it's just going to show an elemental metals in the coolant. And that elemental metals are from something deteriorating from that coolant, and it's usually the cylinder liner. So hopefully, yes, don't fall prey to the snake oil, and then hopefully that answers your question. If I did not answer it in enough clarity, please contact me, and I could either go back and forth with email with you on it, or I could actually address it if you would like on another show. Alrighty, so now we're over here, and we've got our toolbox test question. This combine has a whitish-blue smoke on startup, and we have the three different farmers who told you everything from you bought the wrong color combine to you better save your money, or just forget about it, all right? So now farmer C is correct. In almost every instance, with a gas or diesel engine that has blue smoke on startup, it is valve stem seals or guides. The seals are the most likely cause. When the engine is shut down, the hot oil leaks past the seal and sits on top of the piston and is burned off when combustion occurs. The smoke lasts a short while since there is only a small amount of oil on the piston crown. So keep that in mind. Now also, on a gasoline engine specifically, and on a diesel too, that oil is leaking past the valve, the valve seal, all right, along the stem. It's going to build a lot of carbon on an intake valve, which is going to restrict airflow. But historically, 99% of the time, bluish white smoke on startup is because of a valve stem seal issue, and you're putting some oil down on the top of the piston. All righty, and I wish him a great crop. He doesn't have to buy a new engine, as the one guy said. All right, put new rings in. But most engines and diesels are a pain in the neck because they're much harder to work on. But you could pressurize the cylinder, and you could pop the valve, the retainers and locks off, and usually put seals on if you would gain access to it. So listen, I want to thank you so much for listening to today's show, and I wish you a blessed week, and know that the Hot Rod Farmer is pulling for you, the American farmer and rancher, and my beloved America. So you have a blessed week.